From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bruce Feiler says there's been one story over time, over a long time, thousands of years, one story that has stood at the center of every conversation about men and women. It's the story of Adam and Eve. Feiler has written a book that tells the story of that story, where it came from, what it means, how it actually reads in the Bible. He says it used to be a story about human connection and love, but then something happened. Religious thinkers distorted it, made it about deceit and sin, and who got all the blame, or most of it anyway? Eve did, of course. So Feiler is trying to reclaim the story. He'll join us today to make the case for how Adam and Eve are, actually, no kidding, role models for your relationship today. Join us after the news.
Hey, you. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So for the purposes of today's show, don't get caught up in asking whether Adam and Eve were actual historical figures or whether the Garden of Eden was an actual place. Some of you think there was a literal Adam and Eve. Some of you say that's silly, that it's an allegory. Bruce Feiler's book about Adam and Eve isn't about that. His book is about the story, where it came from and what it means and why it matters. Because Feiler says it does matter. In fact, he says Adam and Eve are the big bang of humanity, even if we don't happen to believe they actually existed, because they teach us about love. He says they're the earliest model of a robust, resilient, long-lasting relationship. So Bruce Feiler is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. He writes the This Life column for the Sunday New York Times. He's also a television host. He's written a number of books, among them Walking the Bible. He joined us from a studio in New York City. I want to begin with the story from Rome. You had a lot of questions, of course, swirling around, and it all came to a head when you and your daughters tagged along with your wife on a business trip to Rome, and you took your daughters to the Sistine Chapel. So let's start with that story, because that seems to have been a really important moment in the way you started to think about all of this.
Well, for me, my process really begins at my kitchen table, and I have a working wife, and I have identical twin daughters. And that means we spend a huge amount of time talking about the thing that in some ways our whole culture is talking about right now, which is how men and women relate to each other and how this is all changing in real time right before our very eyes. And I just think, by the way, you know, just to interject here in my own story, this is especially true with religion, right? Nothing has been more discriminatory against women than organized religion over the centuries, violently sometimes, actively, aggressively, intentionally. And exactly at this moment that religion, in effect, has become voluntary. I'm speaking now as someone who spent decades talking and writing and making television about religion. Yeah. Who could blame women for running the other way? And instead, the opposite has happened. Women care more, are involved more, take more responsibility for passing on values to their children. And so, you know, here's me at the, you know, the dinner table, if you will, every day. And I'm really the one, though it's a little bit, you know, out of gender character, who cares more about this in my house. So all this is sort of the swirl in my head. And as you mentioned, right, so my wife has a trip to Rome. We go on this trip and I'm like, I have the brilliant idea to take my sleep-deprived daughters on day one to the Vatican, and it doesn't go well. They're about eight at the time, right? Yeah. So it's like, what are all these naked statues? Like, why are there carpets on the wall? Like, oh, they're not carpets. Those are tapestry. You know, this is not going very well, right? So I'm like, I'll get them in the Sistine Chapel. Like, come on, girls. I'm going to blow your mind. And I'm like, look up. And one of them looks at that image of God and Adam sailing across the sky and says, well, there's just men there. You know, where am I in that picture?
Yeah.
And her twin, not to be outdone, notices a woman under God's arm. And she says, well, is that Eve?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the moment that, you know, someone like me looks for, which is, oh my gosh, for 3,000 years, this story of Adam and Eve has been at the heart of every conversation about men and women. And that, frankly, as absurd as it sounds, what goes through my mind is maybe it has something to teach us about relationships today.
Mm. I love the story you tell of Michelangelo kind of going rogue as he creates the images there. And something I had not noticed, I had to go back and look at the images of the Sistine Chapel, but right there in the center, I always thought it was the creation, but that's yes. not what Michelangelo had in mind. Maybe say something about that before we move on.
Well, I think that the story, you know, you say move on. So where are we moving on to? We're moving on to a story of essentially what is the original story of Adam and Eve as it appears in the Hebrew Bible say?
Yeah.
And then what did the commentators say about it over the years? And there's a big tension there. In effect, sort of men reading. We're doing this, you know, kind of inside out, which is kind of cool in its own way. But basically, men reading sort of discrimination into the original story, which is very clearly not in the original story when you break it down.
Yeah.
But then there is this sort of rival narrative that begins to pop up, which is when artists and creative people who, as you say, go rogue, who are not in the tradition and whose job it is not to pass on religious values but to interpret them. And Michelangelo plays a big part in that. And as you say, the centerpiece of the Sistine Chapel is not the creation of Adam, which is what we all expect. It's the next one, and that's the creation of Eve.
Yeah.
He puts Eve in the center of the Sistine Chapel. And let's remember, the Sistine Chapel is the malest place on earth. Women weren't even allowed in for another 250 years after he paints this. And that is basically saying that Eve is the centerpiece of the story. She, in that image, you have Adam lying down, Eve being created from Adam's side, which, by the way, is exactly what the Bible says, which is not what the interpreter said.
Yeah.
And Eve is this bridge between Adam and God. Eve is the center. And basically, you know, the Sistine Chapel, it's not just an interpretation of the story. It's part of the story because it becomes the, you know, Michelangelo said, God created the words and I created the pictures,
yeah.
right? And,
yeah.
you know, that becomes a sort of benchmark in how basically women got reread into the story over the centuries.
Early on in the book, you deal with that really important question, you know, why do we need Adam and Eve anymore? If it's like it's this ancient fairy tale. And what do you do with that question? Because you write about this a bit in the book of whether Adam and Eve is an allegory or an actual, you know, historical reality. Because a lot of believers, I have to say, being here in Utah, in the LDS faith, they're still very much believers in the fact that there, you know, there was an Adam and an Eve and there was a Garden of Eden. So what do you – how do you deal with that question?
Well, I think that the LDS question is an interesting question, which is to say that the LDS interpretation of Adam and Eve is much more generous to Adam and
yeah.
Eve than is the traditional Catholic and Protestant interpretation and in some ways even the Jewish interpretation. So that will show you that there is room in this for different points of view. But I think that, look, I mean my core way I've been 20 years doing this, right? So I started with Walking the Bible 20 years ago, which was this idea of going to the places in the story and reading the story in the places. Abraham is about looking how the story of Abraham is at the heart of the tension that we have today among Jews, Christians, and Muslims. I did the same thing with the book on Moses as America's prophet. And sort of my core enterprise is basically trying to figure out a way to make these stories relevant to today. And what interests me in a fundamental way is how these stories get told and retold over time. And the question of are they true, for most of that history, it was a given.
Yeah.
Everybody believed they were true, right? Michelangelo believed the story was true. He interpreted it one way. John Milton in Paradise Lost, he believes the story is true.
Yeah.
Until 150 years ago, everybody believed that the story is true. In some ways, my message is not to the people who believe it's true. It's the people who think that it doesn't matter at all, that it's a fairy tale and that we've moved on and we're smarter and we know better. In some ways, what I'm saying to them is you can't just wipe out 3,000 years of cultural history and pretend it doesn't exist. This story is central to who we are, whether it's straight marriage, you know, gay marriage, mm-hmm. male, role of men, fatherhood in the family, the role of women in the workplace, diaper duty, you know, can we have it all? Lean in. All of these questions in some ways are shaped in ways we never really fully understand by the story of Adam and Eve. If you care about those questions, it's almost like you must care about this story.
They are who we are, you say in the book. And I want to get at this theme, and it seems like this is the—I don't know if it's the all-encompassing theme, but it's really critical, and it's this idea that we humans are cutting ourselves off from others, separating ourselves. You call it the outright plague. And that seemed like the thing you're most concerned with, and that is the thing that we can learn from Adam and Eve is love and connection.
So the first thing I said in this conversation was that for me it begins at my kitchen table. And so if you look at society today, in some ways the outright plague that you quote me as saying is loneliness and is disconnection, right? You've got young people feeling estranged. I looked at a study within the last week that said how Facebook makes us unhappy because everybody is presenting these curated lives that it makes them appear like they're happy and charmed and getting along. And that makes us depressed because our lives are not like that. Well, guess what? They're not. Lives are not like that either. Yeah. You've got this problem of middle-aged men. You've got the opioid crisis. You've got the suicide crisis. You've got old people living longer, feeling more alone. You've got across the lifespan, you have loneliness as the problem. And what do we throw at that today? We throw social science, right? I wrote this column in the New York Times, as you mentioned. And, you know, in that column, I write a lot about contemporary families and contemporary life. And what do? I quote social scientists, you know, the latest research, the latest app. You know, we can be more efficient. We can be smarter. What has positive psychology told us? It has told us that connection is the number one most important thing to well-being, right? Happiness is other people. The opposite of that is loneliness. What's the first thing that God says about human beings in the Bible?
Yeah.
It's not right for human beings to be alone. God gets there. The Bible gets there 3,000 years before modern social science. So if you're the kind of person who says, oh, science has rendered the Bible irrelevant, who needs it anymore? Mm-hmm. Here's a beautiful example where that's not true. And frankly, if you're the kind of person who thinks that the Bible has all the truth we ever need, this is another beautiful example. You know, and to me, in some ways, what I like best about this book is the times where I'm able to mash up the contemporary thinking about our lives and the ancient and say, you put the two in dialogue with each other, then you get at truths. So here's a truth, a fundamental truth, because social science says it and the Bible says it and the oldest story says it. To me, that means pay attention. There's something here that matters to us.
That's Bruce Feiler. He writes the This Life column for the Sunday New York Times. His book is called The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Bruce Feiler is joining us to talk about his book, The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us, which is about, of course, Adam and Eve, who we still blame for bringing death and sin into the world. But Feiler says that's not what that story is about. He says it's about connection and resilience and love. Let's talk about one of the things that you explore in the book is what this Adam and Eve story meant in the ancient world before it started to get twisted, although I'm sure it started to get twisted as soon as it was told. But in the early tellings of it, there are a couple of things that are really interesting and I wanted to ask you about. One of them is that you say that this story represents a kind of radical break from its time in that a couple of things. The story has one God. The story has two people. The two people in the story are in love. And then you bring God into that love story too, that you have two people and then God having a relationship. So will you talk about that part?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the thoughtfulness of the question. And to me, this gets at what is really, as you say, not just a radical break, I think a revolution in thought, right? So I'm in Jerusalem and I go to see this scholar who is the number one scholar of ancient stories. And so, you know, let's remember the Bible comes from a time and a place, and it comes from the ancient Near East. It comes at a time when there are vibrant cultures in Mesopotamia and vibrant cultures in Egypt.
Yeah.
This, of course, is the Fertile Crescent. And in all of those stories, there are explanations for the origins of humankind. And in all those stories, humans come from a god and a god, or from a god and a human. The Bible, the biblical account, is the first in the ancient world that has a man and a woman at the start of the human line, and specifically a man and a woman at the start of the human line who have names, who have personalities, who have a relationship. So that is, in some ways, you know, you could argue that's the most significant part of the story before all the other stuff that we can talk about, you know, the question of the disobedience and the sin and the fall and the parenthood and then the interpretation and the male-female. All this stuff that gets layered onto it misses in some ways the radical thing. It is, you've got one God who, remember, in the beginning of the Hebrew Bible is a male God. Yep. And then suddenly out of nowhere on the sixth day, God sets out to create human beings and says, let us create human beings in our image, okay? So this single God suddenly becomes plural.
Yeah,
right? It's clearly intentional. So you've got this kind of singular plural God who then creates this first human being. This is the first version of the Adam and Eve story, not mm-hmm. the second, right, which has got the fruit and the tree and yeah. the rib and all that kind of stuff. It's not a rib, but we can get to that later.
Right.
Creates this ungendered human being, and then this creation is divided into male and female. So you've got this kind of singular plural God creating this singular plural human and divides them into male and female. So to me, lesson number one here is that there's total equality
right.
between the two sides. What's true for one is true for the other. But second, right now, again, let's just jump to where we are having this conversation today. What are the buzzwords, right? Gender beyond the binary and, you know, understanding identity and sexuality. And we now know that it's not like all women are nurturing and all men are piggish. So there that is in the first story, like that we have male and female within us. Mm-hmm. And God has male, female within God. That's an arresting idea that, as I said, I clearly think is undoubtedly a revolution in thought that the Bible does not get credit for.
God contains both male and female. This idea of completion, pure equality, that seems like that's the thing we're not really getting about that story.
Oh, my gosh. We're not getting that at all.
Yeah.
Because we now read the story through the layers of people who read it over the centuries, and they were trying to read male supremacy into the story.
Yeah.
So we miss two things about it, okay? So we miss the pure equality that's there, that's absolutely there, undeniably there. But we also miss something else, right? And that is the fact that God needs the relationship to succeed, right? So you've got God who gives the power. God is looking for a partner and a partner among the humans, right? That's the whole story of Genesis, right? Starts with Adam and Eve. That's got some challenges, but ultimately works. Then he tries again with Noah. That doesn't work. Then he tries with Abraham. So God is clearly looking for a human partner all through the book of Genesis. Mm-hmm. And he needs the relationship of Adam and Eve to succeed, right? So what's the first thing, of course, he says to them? Be fruitful and multiply. He needs them to succeed. Ultimately, it does succeed after a lot of drama. But it does succeed, and it's because God gives the power of procreation to humanity. He needs humanity to work, to execute his vision on earth, and he needs Adam and Eve to get humanity going. So we miss two things. We miss the equality, and we miss how much God needs the relationship to work.
I think this was important for me, too, in reading the book. So Adam and Eve is actually the first love story. I guess we don't really think, Bruce Feiler, that anything like it came before that. Is that right?
I think it works in two directions. Number one, I think that, yes, what you say is, I think, undoubtedly correct, which is there is no story of this power. In the ancient world, this story would have been told over the centuries. It was first written down 3,000 years ago. That's 1,000 years before Jesus, and that's 500 years before classical Greece,
yeah.
when Plato was writing, say, the Symposium, which is all about the role of love in the world. So nothing came before it that places a relationship between a man and a woman at such a high mark. That's the first thing that matters. The second thing is, you know, love has become more fashionable to talk about in recent decades. And everybody, oh, love begins in the romantic novels, or love begins in the Middle Ages in France with the Art of Courtly Love, or love begins in Rome, or love begins in Greece. Forget all that.
Yeah.
This is 500 years before Greece. It's, you know, whatever it is, 1,500 years before Shakespeare, 2,500 years before Shakespeare, and long before the Middle Ages. And this has a romantic relationship at the heart. And then that gets to the third question, you know. And by the way, all of this is why my book is called The First Love Story.
Yeah.
And then the third question is, well, why don't we see it as love? Partly because we are so busy talking about the sin part of it that we miss the love part of it. But even more importantly, it's like we define love wrong. It's like we think love is the Hollywood version of love, where you meet and then you, you know, you have a little bit of a you have a meet cute. There's a challenging moment. You get to the altar and you live happily ever after, because that's where all the movies end. But that's not what love is.
Yeah.
Love is not a choice. Anybody who's been in a relationship for a weekend knows that's not what love is. Love is a long term. It's a stew. It has complications. It has twists and turns. It has joyful moments and disappointed moments. It may even have sin that you have to overcome. Love is not a choice you make once. It's a choice you make over and over again. And that's the other thing that Adam and Eve introduce, which is the idea of sticking with it through all the twists and turns, the setbacks. You know, as Shakespeare said, you know, to the edge of doom, you love your lover. Well, who knows the edge of doom better than Adam and Eve?
Well, because they're the first story. They have to, as you say in the book, invent what it means to be in a relationship. And that's why it's relevant for us today. As you say, it's not just – and you go through that process of love where there's the lust part and then you move through it. But that seems like that's the message, the sticking through to the end. That seems what makes it – it seems to me anyway, that's what seems to make it relevant for today.
So I think that, you know, again, think of the story oddly in like a Hollywood story, right? You've got the three-act Hollywood story. You've got the meet-cute part of the story, okay? So you've got, you know, Adam in the second version of the story, right, beginning in Genesis 2, you got Adam being created from the earth, and then he's lonely, right? He looks at all the animals, and he said there's no partner there. You know, I think of it as the first Tinder moment. He's like, swipe left, swipe left, swipe left. I don't want to be with a rooster. I don't want to be with a rhinoceros. I don't want to be with a hippo. And he looks up at God, and that's when God says you shouldn't be lonely. And God creates Eve from his side, by the way, not his rib. You know, Selah is the term in Hebrew, which 38 times in the Hebrew Bible means side, side room, whatever. So they're clearly standing side by side. Then you've got the big drama in the middle, which is over the eating of the fruit. It's not an apple. It's just a fruit. And what happens there in that whole moment is you've got the tension. Then they get kicked out of Eden, and that introduces the third act of the story, which is what they do after they leave, which in some ways is the most important because they have two children. One murders the other. They have to reconcile. And I think that that's where you see they stay together, right? They come apart. She goes off to eat the fruit. She comes back to Adam. She shares it with Adam. Adam has the decision. Should he choose God or choose her? He chooses her. They get kicked out of Eden. They could stay apart. They come back together. They have two children. One murders the other. They could split apart. They come back together. It's that stick-to-itiveness that is really powerful and, as you say, absolutely 100% relevant to my marriage of almost 15 years, to any the relationship of anybody that is listening to us today, which is, again, love is not a choice you make once. It's a choice you make over and over again. And it's about telling a story with your partner.
This is what John Milton was getting at in Paradise Lost. This was interesting because I'm trying to figure out how Milton comes to this idea that, as you put it in the book, Adam and Eve, when they're banished from the garden, they're left with each other. And they see this as a sort of a far happier circumstance because they now know each other in all the ways that means, and they're happy about that. And Milton seemed incredibly enlightened about that, it seems, for his time.
Okay, so here's my radical suggestion, you know, as if saying Adam and Eve are in love is not radical enough.
Yeah.
We should not teach Paradise Lost in high school. We should teach the John Milton story. His biography is like sensationally interesting. Okay,
yeah.
So he's basically born right around the time that Shakespeare dies, okay, in the early 17th century. And he's a romantic. He's a Protestant. He stays a virgin until his 30s because he can't find the right woman. He writes these romantic love poetry because he's, you know, fantasizing about this. he's working for his father. He goes to get a scrivener. He gets a document signed from a justice of the peace in Oxford, and he let's presume he comes back with the document, but he comes back with the justice of the peace's 17-year-old daughter, Mary. The two get married. They go up on their honeymoon. She comes. She goes back to tell her parents how it happens, and she never returns again. Right. So he's heartbroken, and he writes 5-track, 60,000 words called the divorce track, saying that love, divorce, which at the time is illegal, should be legal because why? Because you should be able to have a conversation with your spouse. You should, they should be supportive of each other. This is 17th century England. How does he justify it? You got to go back to Adam and Eve. So he says, look, Adam and Eve had this relationship. This is all on the divorce tracks, right? Long before Paradise Lost. Yep. So he rises in the government. He falls. You know, 40 years passes. He's exiled because the king comes back in power and he's been on the wrong side. He gets sent to live across from a cemetery in a place so isolated in London, it's called Jewin Street because it's the only place that the Jews are allowed to live in 17th century England. That's how scandalous it was. And there he goes back to the story that he loved as a young man. He goes back to the Adam and Eve story, and he reinterprets it while entirely blind in iambic pentameter. I mean, it's unbelievable on almost every level. Like he teaches his daughters to read Hebrew so they can read to him. They hated it, by the way.
Yeah.
So, and in the story, they're in love. It's hail wedded bliss when we first meet them. But and then they have this amazing exchange, right, where Eve says, "Hey, Adam, you know this garden's pretty busy. What do you say I help you? You know." the Garden of Eden. And Adam says, are you kidding? No wife of mine is going to do any work. You know, you're too precious, right? And she says, well, you know, that's just not going to work for me. Like, if you don't let me help you, I'm going to go wander off and get into trouble. And he's like, oh my gosh, I got to give you free will. So what am I going to do? So he lets her go off. She goes off. She eats the fruit. And she has this amazing moment where, first of all, she doesn't die, which is what she's been told in the story is going to happen. And she says, oh, man, I should just keep this knowledge to myself. Remember, it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I should just keep this knowledge to myself. It will be a win for the female sex. So, like, she's like this proto-feminist, right? And then she says, well, no, but so much. Oh, dear, I love Adam. I can't do this without him. So she goes back to Adam, and he's like, oh, actually, what am I supposed to do? Like, I can't eat this fruit because I know I'm going to die. But, oh, my gosh, I love Eve so much. So he eats, too. They actively choose each other. That's the great love moment. And Milton Coley gets it right. And as you say, as they leave at the end of the story, they are hand in hand toward a, quote, far happier place. This is called Paradise Lost, but even Paradise Lost has them going to a far happier place, meaning being together is more important than being in the garden.
Why didn't Milton's view stick?
That's a very interesting question, because I think in a lot of ways Milton's view does stick, because I think that he he publishes Paradise Lost, say, in 1665. We're right on the kind of on the lip of the Enlightenment, right? We're on the lip of what becomes the sort of fracture of religion in its kind of total grip on Western civilization. And so he doesn't prevail at the time, but I think that what he does is that this story ripples. So like you go 100 and whatever it is, 30 years later, when Byron and Shelley and Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley are, you know, in Lake Geneva, and then they have this ghostwriting contest, and she writes Frankenstein, and Frankenstein is a whole play on the Adam Eve story. I feel like I'm the last person. I mean, I've written 4 books about the Bible, and I feel like I'm the last person who knew this, by the way. this is about Adam and Eve, right? So Dr. Frankenstein is God, and the monster is Adam. So what happens is the monster, like, this is not in any of the movies, but if you go back and look at the original book, he goes off into the Alps, and he learns to read. How does he learn to read? By reading Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
And he reads Paradise Lost, and he realizes, hey, that's my story. And so he goes marching back to Dr. Frankenstein and says, I'm Adam. I'm lonely. Make me an Eve. And in fact, if you make me an Eve, I'll go off and you know, basically go back into the garden and leave you alone forever. And as we know, Frankenstein doesn't want to do that, and he starts, you know, the monster starts killing people, and it goes horribly wrong. But so that's a story about science and taking over religion. God is not mentioned in Frankenstein, but it relies on Paradise Lost. And then, of course, the last great impact of it is Darwin, when he's on the HMS Beagle. When he goes to the Galapagos and he invents the idea of evolution, which, you know, some people say was the great Bible killer, though I don't agree with that necessarily.
Yeah.
He says, Paradise Lost is his favorite book, and he takes it with him on the Galapagos. So imagine him reading Adam and Eve when he's coming up with the idea of evolution. So Paradise Lost trickles down all the way through the centuries.
Well, you write about how Darwin changed the conversation about how males and females relate to each other. And in some way, even though you don't believe that Darwin made everyone start forgetting about the Bible, it did show the story to be more allegorical, though, than historical.
Well,
that was one thing that was interesting.
Yes. Well, I think to me, let's remember, Darwin had agreed to become a preacher right before he gets on the Beagle and goes off. I mean, like he's got the debate that in his brain that in some ways is the debate that he later kicks off. So I think that in some ways, let's just acknowledge that I'm the fool that's writing a book about Adam and Eve, the first love story. And I say, OK, I'm going to write a whole chapter about Darwin, right? Because this is supposed to be the great enemy. And I basically invited him into the house and say, when I say he changed the conversation, he changed this conversation in my view in the following way, right? Which is he says that, you know, in some ways the primary purpose of mating, you know, in the animal kingdom, if you will, is to pass on your genes, right? Yeah. That's the idea of evolution, and you pass it on and it adapts, right, to the world around. And but if that were the primary goal of being alive, then we wouldn't need marriage. We wouldn't need families. We wouldn't need love.
Right.
But yet we have it. And in fact, you know, Darwin wrote a whole book about this subsequent to The Origin of the Species. And, you know, the idea is that so we have this kind of vertical line where we are passing on our genes, but we also have this horizontal way of living, which is that we break away from that and we form families. That's not an efficient way to pass on genes. Why do we do that? It's the best way to have to rear healthy offspring who can go into the world and thrive in the world, right? So you need a family. But a family is contradictory to that impulse. And so that's why we have love. We have love, which is the glue that binds the family together, which turns out to be extremely effective, maybe the most effective way to successfully pass on your genes and to continue the species. And that's what I see in Genesis, right? So Genesis is – what is the word Genesis comes from? It's the generations. It's the idea of the beginning and the begatting that we all made fun of in grade school about the story of Genesis. But the Adam and Eve story is not just the generational. It's not just the vertical passing. It's the horizontal break that says you need both. And therefore, I think Darwin – enhances our understanding of Adam and Eve because it shows why we need that story, why we need love, and why we need, in particular, that relationship to work.
How do you make sense of the snake? You write about how serpents have long been associated with deception in the ancient Near East. What role does the snake play as a figure?
Well, that's an interesting – it's a very interesting question, and I think that – at a minimum, you know, the snake is temptation. It's the outside forces that are at play in any relationship, if you will. Deeper than that, to me, I think it's – first of all, I think it's ambiguous, right? So on the one hand, snakes in the ancient world were very negative. They're poison, they're death, they're unknown, et cetera. But they're also positive. The whole idea of the snake wrapped around the scepter as the story of health, which we still have in the American Medical Association, you know, symbol today, that goes back to the ancient world. So I think it's ambiguous. Is the snake helping the story along by saying you need to have this knowledge of good and evil in order to be human, in order to fully fulfill God's commandment to be fruitful and multiply? That's always been the tension in the story. Like, it's sin, but it's kind of necessary sin at the same time. Like, all the traditions need the sin in order to work. And Adam and Eve have to go through that difficulty in order to fully, you know, realize themselves as a relationship and in order to have the children that gets the biblical story going. But then there's this other thing, which is that over time, particularly in the Middle Ages, right, the snake begins to take on these quasi-human forms, right? So in the Sistine Chapel, the snake has got a woman, a female head on it, right? So what is that? So suddenly the snake is not just temptation. The snake is infidelity, right? The snake is sexual wandering. It's the sort of the dark sexuality that passes on the good sexuality. This is not just today that we have this. We've had this forever. And then that gets to the other question, which is, you know, this idea of Lilith, right? And the idea that not just, you know, Eve has a temptation, but that Adam has a temptation. Lilith is the first wife in the medieval tradition, right? And so that to me, the way I look at the story is like, you know, sort of Adam has his dalliance with Lilith and Eve has her dalliance with the snake. And today, you know, who among us has, you know, pure love? The first person you set eyes on, you were with together. This is not the Middle Ages where you got married to, you know, at 13 or 14 or 15 or 16 to someone your parents selected. We all have past loves, and those past loves kind of haunt us. And I think that's another way that the story is relevant. Certainly one of the things I wrote a book about country music, as you know, and my favorite Garth Brooks song, I can't believe I'm going to bring Garth Brooks into this conversation, is Unanswered Prayers, right? So Guy, you know, Garth singing the song in first person, but the guy goes to his high school, you know, reunion with his wife, and he runs into his high school girlfriend, and he remembers, oh my gosh, every single night I used to pray to God to make you mine. And exactly in the moment in the story where you think he's going to leave the wife and go to the high school girlfriend, he looks at her and he realizes, you know, it's not clear. Is, you know, maybe she's not so attractive. Maybe she's had a different life. For whatever reason, he says, you know what? You're not right for me. I'd rather be with my wife. Some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. Well, you know, that's the snake to me. That's Lilith to me. It's this idea that we have past love and yet we choose to be in the love that we're in. Love, as I keep saying, love is not a choice you make once. It's a choice you make over and over again.
Bruce Feiler. His book is called The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Bruce Feiler. We're talking about his book, The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. I want to come back to the Sistine Chapel again. I have to say, this was one of my favorite parts of the book, just reading how incredibly complicated it is to get into the Sistine Chapel alone. And explain why it is you wanted to. I mean, you could, you know, as you did with your daughters, you could go, and I've done this, you know, you go in with the tourists, the 2,000 people who. But why was it so important for you to stand in there and look up and be alone?
Oh, because I'm a fool. I mean, you know, I mean, I could give you all the beautiful reasons, but I like to, when I wanted to read Noah's Ark, I wanted to do it on top of Mount Ararat, right?
Yeah,
you know, so, you know, when I wanted to write about the Exodus, I wanted to cross the Red Sea. It's like the part of me that I think of myself as two things, actually. I think of myself as an experientialist. I like to go off and experience the world. I grew up in the age of discount airfare. That's how I like to learn. And so I like to go off and do things. And then I think of myself as an explainaholic. It's a word I first heard Asimov use. And it means I like to go off and do something and then come back and explain to you what happened. So that's kind of who I am. And so I like say half blithely but half like determined, hey, I want to be in the Sistine Chapel alone. What's it like? Well, that turns out that's a little complicated. I mean, there are three ways to do it. You can be in a papal conclave, which for a whole bunch of reasons I'm not eligible for. Number two, you can do what you and I did until that moment, which is, you know, you can buy a ticket, wait in line, be there with 2,000 people for 10 minutes. You can't sit down, talk, or take pictures. Or you can – it turns out you can buy your way in, right? So you can – I met this – I know this guy in Rome who helped somebody do – he paid $60,000, flew in 60 people, put him in hotel rooms around Rome. He's going to have his 60th birthday party in the Sistine Chapel. By the way, this is like the modern indulgences.
Yeah.
And then this is why the Protestant Reformation happened, right? Right? That's what Luther was pounding on those gates, right? You know,
it's
like
true.
You can just buy your way to heaven.
Yeah.
So he's going to have a birthday party in the Sistine Chapel, and the Vatican calls the morning of and says, sorry, Portia came in and played, is paying more money. Your birthday party is canceled. Okay, so I'm not going to pay $60,000. I don't have $60,000 to pay. So I start pulling strings, and I pulled a little too hard, and I end up getting in twice, right? So once with a graduate student who's, you know, great, 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 whatever. Grandfather was the original librarian. He takes me in. And then I end up going in with the chief Latinist who takes me in. And I have to say, being in there alone, you notice a couple of things. First of all, the floor is nice, right? It's got this like marble floor that you never look at.
Yeah.
Second, it kind of vibrates that room. Like, well, it's like almost like a reed instrument. I'm like a kaleidoscope. It swirls around you. It's so overwhelming. I talked to a man who's been in with conclaves, and he was like, you know, you're constantly, you know, craning your neck. They're reading a passage, and you're looking up to see it on the ceiling. but you do see how the whole thing is built around the woman and how the story evolves. So in the first image, you've got God and Adam with Eve under God's arm. In the second image we were talking about earlier, you've got Eve in the center. But in the third image, you really see them as partners. You see the two lovers kind of intertwined very erotically. And by the way, they're both reaching for the fruit.
Yeah.
It's not an apple, by the way. In fact, again, Michelangelo knows his Bible. He's got it as figs, which is what I think it is, because we know there are figs there.
Right.
They look very much like testicles, by the way, I should say. And then her head, by the way, is near his very naked crotch. And if she turns her head in one direction, you've got a scene that's unfit for papal consumption, which by the way, the Vatican knows this because for hundreds of years you couldn't reproduce that image.
Yeah.
But they're very intertwined. They're very connected until they leave Eden. And in the last image to the right of the third panel, you have again Eve retreating into the shadows, which of course is what happens over the centuries.
No mention of sex in the original account. But there is, you say, the story of Adam and Eve, they are sexual beings, or they're naked, and yet we make this shift from them being these sort of frolicking sexual beings to something more shameful. I guess in part we can blame Augustine, at least, or Augustine. I talk a little bit about this part too, because I really liked this switch, the idea of how Mae West also comes into the picture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me it's sort of like, you know, how sex becomes evil and how it unbecomes it, right? So in the original story – in the Genesis 2 account, okay, you've got Adam is looking for a partner. As I said, he doesn't find it. God creates Eve. I mean, by the way, the greatest Hollywood meet cute, right?
Yeah.
He wants a girl. Yeah. He falls asleep. He wakes up. There's a girl. And what does he say? You're the one. I mean, he's like a guy. Like, he like falls in love like 2 seconds, right? You know, it takes her longer. And what does he say? You're bone of my bone. You're flesh of my flesh, right? This is, you know, public radio. I don't need to spell this out, but bone and flesh. There's clear sexual arousal and sexual attraction. And then what does the text say? The two of them are naked and know no shame, right? Naked and know no shame, bone, flesh. It's a clear, full sexual relationship at that time.
Yeah.
So what happens? What happens is they eat the fruit and then they open their eyes and they feel shame. And by the way, the fact that it's shame and not guilt really matters because guilt is internal and shame is when you see other you see yourself as others see you, right? So you have the kind of the introduction of civilization at this point. And so Augustine looks into this and says, this is not just their shame. It's everybody's shame, right? The original sin, we all are infected by this. And, you know, Augustine's a complicated figure because he had a child out of wedlock. He had a Christian mother and a pagan father. But so he basically puts this on and a lot of people fight back. But this ultimately prevails. And so Adam and Eve become this sort of icon of sexual shame. The sexual act is what brings down the fall as it comes to be known. So over time, you know, artists and creative people begin to do it, to retell the story. But the big change, frankly, doesn't come until the 19th century when for the first time women start speaking about the story. And then you see women trying to re-equalize and kind of reclaim their voice. And to me, you know, you've got Elizabeth Cady Stanton who does this in a very powerful way, and she's shamed for rewriting the story of Adam and Eve. But, you know, you teed it up. If I have time to tell it, I'll just quickly tell
Please,
the Mae West story.
Absolutely.
So it's December 12th, 1937. Mae West goes on the number one radio show at the time, the Chase and Sanborn Radio Hour at 8 o'clock on Sunday nights on NBC. She's at the height of her power. She's been in prison for sexuality. She's known as kind of sexing things up. And they do – she does a skit about Adam and Eve, whatever it is, 3 weeks before Christmas. So Eve plays Mae West plays Eve. Don Ameche plays Adam. I'm convinced because he's the only person in Hollywood who's shorter than Mae West, even though it's radio. I mean, because there's this scene in the book where I go and look at her clothes in a museum in Hollywood, and she's got this triple-decker shoe. She's like 4'8". And, you know, the reason that she sways her hips is because she's wearing these triple-decker shoes that are like, you know, 12 inches off the ground, because if she lifts up her feet, she falls over.
Yeah.
So she's Eve. Don Ameche is Adam. And the snake – your favorite character, the snake is played by Charlie McCarthy, right?
Yeah.
So he's just breaking out. And of course, all this has to get through the censor, and Mae sexes up. Oh, are you happy to see me? Or is that a wooden nose? I mean, you know, it's like it's almost like shticky because it's like has this kind of vaudeville quality to it. But they do this thing, and she is like, oh, Adam, I'm so bored. I'm like bored right down to my marriage certificate. We're just sitting around playing gin rummy. Like a girl's got to have some fun. And he says, well, and he's like Mr. Chamber of Commerce. He's like, it's great here. The weather's wonderful. There's plenty to eat. Like who could want more? And so she goes off and she eats the fruit and she meets the snake. And she says, I got to feed this to Adam. And the snake is like, well, he ain't going to go for it because he knows it's not good. And she's like, I'll turn it into applesauce. Which I have to say, I don't get. Like, I've read it. I've heard the original story. Yeah. I don't get the joke. I mean, it doesn't translate. So she goes and feeds the applesauce to Adam. And lightning, you know, and he's like, oh, my God, I've ruined everything. There's thunder. They're getting kicked out of Eden. And she, of course, loves it. She's like, oh, my God, I've made a little history. I just had the big first fat original kiss. So that's all fine. But what happens next is what makes it interesting, right, which is that now it's commonplace. But at the time, it had never happened before. There's a huge organized letter writing campaign where people deluged Congress and the, you know, Washington and the White House and NBC, like, you have ruined religion to my virginal daughter's ears, right? And so NBC, and it turns out this was organized, right, mm-hmm. frankly, by a pro-Catholic group that we know all about those kinds of pro-religious groups now. And but NBC is petrified and Charlie McCarthy is a big star. And so basically, Mae West, the biggest person in Hollywood at the time, is banned from radio for life. So she goes head-to-head with the Adam and Eve story and is flattened. And it's really not until the second wave of feminism in the 1960s that women went back and rewrote the story that really Eve and Elizabeth Cady Stanton prevail, and we can come to see Adam and Eve as the equals that we see them as today.
Pope Francis came to the United States in 2015, comes to Philadelphia. And you were there providing commentary for CNN at the time. And I wanted you to tell this story because it's interesting. The Vatican had released an advanced copy of the remarks that he was supposed to give. But the event went on and on and on. And so Pope Francis sort of ditches his speech and he speaks off the cuff. And he talks about Adam and Eve, and it was really remarkable. Talk about what you heard the Pope say.
First of all, Doug, I appreciate this, and your listeners should know. Like I've done a few interviews about this, but no one gets to the end of the book, so thank you very much. I love this moment because it shows how far we've come, right? Let's remember, my book begins in the Sistine Chapel, right? And in the middle is all about Michelangelo and how daring and rogue it was. And here we are. Here's Pope Francis in front of whatever it is. We'll call it a million people. I'm there 20 yards from him in this booth at CNN. We're supposed to be off the air. We had agreed to go off the air at 8, and at this point it's like 10:30, yeah. Right? Because, you know, Sister Sledge has got to sing We Are Family, and Marky Mark makes all these inappropriate jokes, and Aretha Franklin comes out and sings Amazing Grace and leaves and doesn't even acknowledge the Pope sitting behind her. She has to issue an apology the next day. I mean, it's like the thing goes on and on and on. And he's prepared the most beautiful, well-argued speech about the role of Adam and Eve and love and family and the history of the Catholic Church that is absolutely like word for word the thesis that I have been piecing together for the last 2 years. Yeah. And what he says is, you know, that the family is the most important thing, that love is the most important thing, but it's the most vulnerable thing. And we have to recapture this reason that God has come into the world through a family. And we have to see the story. And he even says, I know what you're saying. Like, who am I? Like, an old man, not married, to talk about this. What do I know? But I know it's hard being married. I know it's difficult being a family. And that's not even to talk about mothers-in-law. Like, you know, he's the most famous bachelor in the world, and he makes a mother in like a Borscht Belt mother-in-law, yeah, joke, in front of all these people that is just lame as could be, frankly. But it's really a passionate thing about we have to see love and we have to see this relationship for what it is, which is the success that God wants it to be. This is powerful, Doug. We have come, the Catholic Church has used this story to dump on women for millennia. And now the Pope, because it's effortless, because it's who he is, because it's where the culture is, says we need to rethink the story and find our own lives within it.
He says the story is about – it's not about sin and disobedience. It's about forgiveness and, as you put it, modeling resilience. Let me ask you that finally, because this seems like where you come down, that you say in this sort of fast-changing world, even if we lose it for a time – this is a story of how we cultivate and keep and come back to love, I guess?
I think resilience is really important and under-discussed. And I think that Adam and Eve begin that, right? And so we know after they leave Eden, they have two children. One of them murders another. We think, I bet if we had a show of hands of anybody listening to us today, don't lift your hand if you're driving, but anybody listening to us today, you know, does losing a child destroy a relationship? My guess is that most hands would go up. But it turns out that's not true. I talked to this woman, you know, we're having this conversation in the West, who studied 271 families who lost children in Mount St. Helens for 35 years. Only a handful broke up. And I said, why did they do this? And she says that they, you know, there's pain the first year and there's pain the second year. And then after year three, four, or five, they look across the table and they realize that the other person is the only person who knows their pain. And they realize that they have to help each other get through it. It was my wife, by the way, interestingly, who says to me, you got to bring in Hamilton. Like the very end of Hamilton, we've got Alexander and Eliza are estranged because he's been cheating on her. And then they lose their son, Philip, in a duel. And they come together and they sing what to me is the highlight of the musical. It's Quiet Uptown. They take long walks. They go into the garden, interestingly enough. And then they hold hands. And the company sings forgiveness. Can you imagine? Okay. You know, the only thing strong enough to overcome an act of incredible pain is an act of imagination. And that's what Adam and Eve do. They come together. It's clear the Bible says there's a separation. They lift each other up together. The language is very different from the birth of Cain and Abel. And they have a third son, Seth. And it's that son, Seth, who goes on to populate the human line and that allows them to fulfill God's commandment to be fruitful and multiply. They forgive. They are resilient. They bounce back. And that's the number one thing I learned from this, Doug. I went in to write a story about Adam and Eve, and I ended up writing, to my surprise, a book about love. And the number one thing I learned about love is that love is a story we tell with another person. Okay? It's co-creation through co-narration. And it's the co. It's the fact that it's a two-story, as you talked about earlier. Not a one-story, a two-story, with two protagonists, two people who have to succeed and overcome their fears and reach the desire and the life that they want. That's what Adam and Eve introduce, and I think we need to see that today because you know what? Relationships have become commodified. Reality TV and, you know, Real Housewives and celebrities and all that. There's so many role models of relationships breaking up, and we need one that sticks together. We need Adam and Eve.
Bruce Feiler, his book is The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Adrian Moranville. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.